all the itinerary.
Joanne, I'd like to convene the June 16th, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We're going to be talking this morning about sudden oak death syndrome, and I'd like to open an informational meeting on that topic. First up, I'd like to call on Peter Doherty, please. And was the intention
to
call up?
To come up together, yeah.
All right. And Nancy Osterbauer and Everett Hansen, please. Good morning to each of you. Welcome. And we look forward to your commentary on a topic that threatens, I guess, to be a rather significant possible negative impact on some areas here in our state. I understand the Roseburg area is very concerned. Please determine among yourselves the order of your testimony. And again, thank you for your appearances.
Yeah, good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Department of Forestry's Private Division Chief. With me is Nancy Osterbauer, Program Manager at the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and Everett Hansen, Professor Emeritus at Oregon State University.
Welcome.
We are here to provide an update on the status of sudden oak death in Oregon's forest. We last presented a sudden oak death update to this committee in 2012. And during that hearing, we noted that when we came back to this committee, we were pretty sure of two things we would be telling you. One was that the disease has spread, and that two, the quarantine will need to be expanded. We will be telling you both of those things today. Sudden oak death is caused by a non-native... That's okay. Sudden oak death is caused by a non-native pathogen, Phythophthora ramorum, commonly called sudden oak death or SOD. As you may recall, sudden oak death has a broad host range, but in Oregon, tan oak drives the epidemic. It is highly susceptible and produces a lot of spores. The disease kills tan oak readily by causing cankers on the main stem. Other hosts are only infected when they are near infected tan oaks. The origin of the disease is unknown. We do not know its natural range or distribution. There's also a lag period between initial infection and development of visible symptoms. This lag is a challenge for early detection and rapid response because the disease can spread during this time before it shows symptoms. There's a variety of potential avenues for dispersal, from canopy drip causing short-term dispersal to wind, to wind-driven rain causing long-distance spread, and humans may also contribute to the spread by moving plants. Currently, thousands of tan oaks are being killed in Curry County. Those are the dead trees you see in those pictures.
Wow.
Sudden oak death was discovered in 2001, but it's been in Oregon since 1998. We have been unable to determine how the disease got to Oregon, but it was likely the result of infected plants brought into Oregon from California. There was a second introduction at Cape Sebastian in 2009 and 2010, and I'll talk a little bit more detail about that later. Go ahead.
Okay.
So we're going to be talking about the sudden oak death program in Oregon's forest. And our program started as an eradication effort with five components. I will focus on the first three, survey, detection, and treatment, discussing lessons learned and effectiveness. Nancy will be discussing quarantines and their impact, and Everett will discuss the research that makes the program possible. Sudden oak death was originally discovered by aerial survey and verified by ground checks. This approach served as our initial detection method. As a program got established, we started ground scouting to be able to see infections that were in the lower crown that you couldn't see from the air. And then we added stream baiting as a way to detect it within a watershed. Finally, we've added ground-based transects to actually find the disease below the canopy. And that's probably our earliest detection method because it can find infections that have not yet infected the trees. Delineation and treatment are intended to completely eliminate the disease from the infested sites. Early on, we defined treatment buffers of 100 to 300 feet around the infected trees, 1 to 6 acres. We moved to a standard of 300 feet partway through the effort, and we've recently concluded that 600-foot buffers, 26 acres around the affected trees, are much more effective at containing the disease. Next slide. Treatment is intensive and expensive, $3,000 to $5,000 per acre. Treatment involves cutting and burning host species, that's tan oak, rhododendron, huckleberry, sometimes myrtle, and more than 6,000 acres have been treated in Curry County to date. Approximately 25% of these treatments have been on federal land, mostly BLM. Eradication can eliminate the disease and stop spread if infestations are detected early and treatments are completed promptly and at the proper scale. That's before the disease has spread. This is a picture of an Emily Creek site on USDA Forest Service land. It was discovered and treated in 2008. And this one we did the 600 foot. The total treatment area was 27 acres. And no disease has been found on the site or nearby for 6 years. So we can locally eradicate it. If the infestation's not treated, the disease intensifies rapidly. In this image from the general infested area in Curry, you only see a few red or dead tan oaks in that picture in 2012. Next slide. 2 years later, 50% of the overstory tan oaks are dead. So without treatment, it can rapidly intensify.
Wow.
Next slide. And now I'm going to go a little bit of the history. As we mentioned earlier, our initial efforts focused on eradication. In 2001, when we discovered it, we had 9 infested sites with an infested area of 36 acres. The quarantine was 9 square miles. And we treated 38 acres, so, you know, small, maybe an acre around each tree. Next slide. In 2006, we saw the first big increase in spread due to weather. There were 2 consecutive years of unusually wet spring and early summer weather, and we think that's to be the greatest contributing factor for this initial spread. We had 36 infested sites with an infested area of 40 acres. The quarantine was expanded to 25 square miles. By 2010, the quarantine had expanded to 154 square miles. The amount of disease now exceeded our capacity to cut and burn all infested sites on non-federal lands. The BLM Forest Service continued to treat their sites. Some of the treatment delays leading to the increase to spread were attributable to gaps in available funding, but we were also learning that the lag between infection and disease symptoms was greater than we thought, and our treatment areas were too small. So at that point, we made a strategic decision to treat high-priority sites near the edge of the quarantine area and leave others untreated. 2010 was a turning point, too much disease to treat with available funds. Next slide. We're looking at 2012, and I'm going to point your attention to the northernmost yellow circle that identifies the Cape Sebastian infestation. This has recently been determined to be a probable result of human-assisted spread based on some of the work that Everett's done. But this site's also an example of the potential effectiveness of treatment. We treated it rapidly with a 900-foot buffer because it was so far north. 94 acres were treated, much of it on Oregon State Parkland, and the disease has been eliminated from that site. So we were successful in getting that. Next slide. In 2013, the quarantine was expanded to 264 square miles. We have a, what we call a generally infested area where we no longer require treatment. That's the red box. And you'll see that we have intensification of the disease. The yellow and pink spots are infected trees in the generally infested area, and wildfire and tree fall risk are increasing in the generally infested area. Now, that brings us up to date. I'm going to talk in more detail about the 2014 and 2015 findings. We identified 14 infested sites. Those are the outside the generally infested area, and those are in yellow. Several of those were close to the edge of the quarantine boundary, and one of them was outside. The three highest priority sites to the north were treated with a 300-foot buffer. All other high-priority sites received minimal treatment. We cut and burned or cut and piled infected trees with a buffer of 20 to 50 feet. And treatments on all federal land are either completed or underway. As of June 8th, 2015, this month, we've detected 11 new infestations outside the generally infested area and two new infections on previous sites. Those are the yellow circles. The white. I'm going to point to a couple of them. There's two sites north of the Pistol River up to the left there. The northernmost one has been cut and piled. The southern site of those two will be delayed until fall because of fire risk. The one large site in the very southern part, it's located on the Windchuck River, 1.5 miles north of the California border. This is likely one we missed in our detection efforts because it's 50 acres when we found it, so it's been there at least for a while. Treatments on this one will also be deferred to the fall. It's been extremely dry in Curry County, which may limit the disease spread, but it also means we have not been able to burn, which is part of the treatment. Now, I'd like to put this kind of history of the treatment and the expansion within the context of what's called an invasion curve when an invasive species arrives. And so this is for the invasion of sudden oak death in Curry County. So you can see it was introduced in 1998. We detected the disease 3 years after establishment, and we had a window between 2001 and 2005 which eradication was possible. And I'd like to say if we knew then what we know now, we could have been successful. You know, it was an unknown disease when it came in. We didn't know about the lag period. By 2010 and 11, we realized eradication was unlikely and would take substantial resources. So as the disease expands on the right side, control costs go up. So understanding that, we moved to the current strategy of slowing the spread. Now in 2015, we've reached a point of needing to evaluate that slow the spread strategy as control costs are increasing, and we do not have sufficient funds to continue the slow the spread as the approach was designed. You know, we're not treating all the outlying areas at the ideal level of treatment. A couple lessons learned. If we want to successfully respond to sudden oak death or any other invasive pest, if or when it arrives in another county, we need to be able to do two things. We need to find it soon after its arrival, and we must be prepared to act while we're in this lower part of the curve where eradication is feasible and at lower cost. This will require a good early detection system and an adequately funded response program. Next slide. So speaking, going to give you a little bit on the expenditures aside between 2001 and 2014. Nearly all the funds have been from state and federal agencies. The U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management have been excellent partners. The federal government has provided over $13 million of the $16 million of expenditures that we've done. Oregon has spent just under $3 million. And the funds from the private sector are mostly in-kind contributions from South Coast Lumber, Coos Curry Electric Cooperative, and numerous small landowners. So $16 million over 14 years. Next slide. And as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the talk, there's a proposed quarantine expansion. That's the outer line, and Nancy will talk more in detail about the expansion and why it's proposed as it is. And so as shown on the invasion curve, we are at another turning point with the cost of the Slow the Spread program exceeding available funds. The SOD technical team has been developing program alternatives. I've asked them to work on a full range of alternatives, and so we have transitioning to living with the disease. That is, we will stop trying to contain it, and we would be only providing technical assistance, education, and best management practices. We would expect the rate of spread to be slightly faster than it is in Northern California, and it would reach Coos County in 10 years. Alternative two would be continue the current Slow the Spread program as funded today. The rate of northward spread is similar to that in recent years, and we think it would reach Coos County in 15 years. Alternative three would be to continue the Slow the Spread program with enhanced funding to enable treating all new infestations outside or outlying the quarantine area. We think we could get the rate of spread down to 1.5 miles a year, and it'd reach Coos in 25 years. And then alternative four is to try to contain a pretty aggressive program, and it would establish that cross-hatched action zone up near the border of the Coos and Douglas counties. It would also create a contingency fund for rapid response in the action zone or outside of Curry County. Now, in all of this, in all my, go ahead.
Do you mind if I, Chair, please. Do you mind if I interrupt and ask a question? On the crosshatch area, you're talking about, you know, the risk to Coos County in a period of time, but is this just as big a risk to Douglas and Josephine as it is to Coos, or is there some climate or geographic issue that prevents it from moving inland that far?
Chair Witt and Representative McCohen, no, there is a risk that it would move up the Rogue River Canyon into Douglas. I think Everett can speak more to the risk. Yeah, it follows the distribution of tan oak. And so on the right side of the map, the it's harder to see in this particular thing, but the darker the orange red is the risk map that shows the spread up, the cases where it could spread. So it would follow the path of the red. Yellow is lower risk, and green is very low risk.
And that's just because of the prevalence of tan oak.
Tan oak, okay. Which is a major source of spread.
But it is a risk beyond Coos County as well.
Correct.
Okay.
I think the focus on Coos County is concerned with the port. But sure. Any logs coming from a quarantine area, and I think Nancy will speak more about the restrictions that happen when a county becomes quarantined.
Okay. Thank you. It's McEwen, by the way.
Oh, McEwen. My apologies.
Happens all the time.
Okay, so when I've talked about the rate of spread and our expected arrival in, say, Coos or Douglas, that's all based on natural spread through rain or wind-driven rain events. Human-assisted spread is a wild card. It could show up through human transport of an infected plant tomorrow. And that's why we're considering a contingency fund with a rapid response ability as one of the alternatives. Next slide. So just to reassure you, we are planning to continue the Slow the Spread program as currently funded as we develop and evaluate alternatives to inform the policy discussion. We do want to protect Tan Oak and other forest ecosystems at risk in North America and elsewhere in the world. We also want to evaluate the potential cost to the nursery and forest products industry as the disease progresses. And with that, I'm planning to turn it over to Nancy to discuss the quarantine and their impacts.
Thank you very much. Morning.
Hi, Chair, committee members. I'm Dr. Nancy Ostbar from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I manage the plant health program there and have been working on sudden oak deaths since I started with the agency. So I think I got 3 years of leeway before sudden oak death hit. So I've been working on it since 2001. So as Peter was alluding to, there's really two quarantines that affect anywhere that has Phytophthora morum present. One is a domestic quarantine that's in place by the feds, and that controls all interstate movement of any host plant material coming out of the quarantine area. And then, of course, we have our state quarantine, and that's mostly concerned with intrastate movement. And that dictates, you know, we kind of set the rules for how they can move stuff within Oregon so we don't have any spread within our state. So I'm going to get right into some of the impacts it's going to have on the different timber species that are down there. The most onerous regulations apply to tan oak. If you want to move tan oak logs interstate, there's a couple things you have to do. One, you have to have it debarked to federal standards. And what that means is that an individual log can have no more than 5% bark left on it. An entire shipment of logs can have no more than 2% in total on it. So it's pretty high standard for debarking. I think really it's only the debarkers that prepare logs for paper pulp, for chipping for paper pulp, that can actually meet that standard. The material has to be harvested from a disease-free area. That means that there can't be any infected tan oak within a quarter mile of the tan oak that you're harvesting. And you have to have had that area officially surveyed within the last 6 months. And ODF has been doing that with some of the funds from U.S. Forest Service. The other thing that you need is an official quarantine, a certificate of quarantine compliance, and that's issued by Oregon Department of Agriculture. Right now, we have a system operating for South Coast Lumber down there under a compliance agreement, and that's how we work with them to kind of ease this process a little bit so that they can move their material more easily interstate. Now, if they want to move it intrastate, the requirements are a little bit less onerous, but you still want to harvest your tan oak from a disease-free area. And we've also asked that they try to protect it from contamination prior to shipment. That means, you know, getting foliage debris and that kind of material caught on there. We have in rule right now that if you try to harvest tan oak within the generally infested area, it can't leave the quarantine area. The chances that it's infected are so high that it's just, the risk is too great, in our opinion, to try to move it outside of the quarantine area. And that would be that little red box that Peter talked about earlier that's mostly in and around the town of Brookings. It's at about 58 square miles right now, but the chances are pretty good we'll have to expand that here in the near future. The good news is if it's Douglas fir or alder or something like that, it was considered either a non-boll host, which means it doesn't infect the trunk, or just a non-host, which would be, alder would be an example of that. That can move pretty freely in and outside of the quarantine area. You don't really need to do any, jump through any special hoops unless it's from an infested site where we know sudden oak death is present, because then there are rules that USDA APHIS, our federal counterparts, have in place that say there can't be any soil associated with those logs, there can't be any leaf litter or anything like that, because that's considered the potential carrier for sudden oak death moving from the site. But otherwise, you know, if you're harvesting Douglas fir logs from anywhere else, your chances are pretty good that you're going to be able to move it relatively easily. And you don't have to worry about getting a certificate of quarantine compliance or anything like that. So that's nice. if we're talking about other commodities, such as nursery stock, Christmas tree plantations are considered nursery stock under the federal regulations, so they're treated the same way. It's a little bit more complicated because that plant material is there, and some of it, I think Everett's probably going to talk about, are you going to talk about hosts a little bit? Okay. Some of them are really good at, you know, they get infected, but they don't die like tan oak does. So they kind of become these typhoid Mary carrier type plants. So that's kind of the challenge with nursery stock. So we have to go into these nurseries and inspect them monthly to make sure that their plant material is free of any symptoms. And also have to test it at least annually. And then whenever they're shipping interstate, they have to have what's called the federal shield, which means that they're under a compliance agreement with USDA APHIS that says that, yes, you know, we're going through all these hoops, we're having our monthly inspections, we're having our testing, so that our material is safe to ship interstate. Specialty forest products have to be harvested from a disease-free area. U.S. Forest Service has been really good cooperators with this in that they'll only issue permits or when they issue permits to folks that are going out and collecting materials from Forest Service lands, they tell them, very specifically tell them, these are areas you can't harvest from because of the risk of sudden oak death and moving it around. But they are supposed to have a certificate as well if they want to move this material interstate. We had a company down there that was doing Flora Pacifica that was doing like potpourri and wreaths and that kind of thing, and they had to come up with their own special treatment for bay laurel, for Oregon myrtle, because they use that in some of their materials and that stuff. The treatment that USDA APHIS had at the time was something like boiling it in water for an hour, and they said it was a really good way to kill all their employees because it smelled so bad. So they had to come up with a different treatment option completely in order to be able to even to ship the material interstate. There are requirements for soil or media that's been associated with an infected plant. And I do want to emphasize that it has to be associated with an infected plant. If it's not, there's not a requirement for it. But if it is, then you have to treat it.
Representative McEwen has a question, I think.
Thank you, Chair Whitten. And if you would like me to wait until you're all done, I can just make a list.
No, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. On the specialty forest products piece, we have a lot of people who are out in the forest harvesting ferns and all kinds of greens, and it's a very common practice down where I live. So when you talk about specialty forest products, how are we educating these folks who are out moving specialty forestry products?
Chair, Representative, mainly they're mostly going on Forest Service land and BLM land.
So they're permit involved?
Yes, and the Forest Service and BLM have been very proactive in terms of educating folks and letting them know that these are areas that it's dangerous for you to harvest in, or they just won't issue a permit at all for that area, and they'll say you can't harvest in this area. Okay. And then so they've been very good in terms of helping provide education to those folks that do that.
And I want to back up a little bit. Could you touch on, I'm very familiar what you do with spruce and Doug fir and the normal tree products that come mm-hmm. through our mills and get shipped for whatever purposes out of our ports, but I'm not as familiar what the use for tan oak is. What is the primary commercial value of tan oak? How is it used?
Chair and Representative, my understanding is right now they're using it mostly for paper pulp.
Okay.
They chip it and then they use it. So it's
ending up in a chip pile and going overseas.
Yes.
Okay. So it doesn't have a lot of value in a. They're not using it in milling of any kind.
They're not, but I'll touch on a little bit how it does impact the overall cost and the for timber companies. So I'll touch on that a little bit.
Great. Thank you.
Now, in terms of international markets, shipping to international markets, right now there are 52 countries in the world that list Phytophthora morum as a harmful organism. What that means is that if we ship something to them and they test it and they find Phytophthora morum present, then they have really three options available to them. They can reject the shipment, which is basically send it back to us. They can destroy it at the port, or they can require some kind of a treatment at the port. And then the exporter, our company, would have to bear the cost of whatever that was. So that's the concern there. There are seven countries, that have a quarantine specifically on Curry County. And the thing with the international markets is that they don't recognize the partial county boundary that we have in place right now. They just go by the county lines because that's much easier for them to deal with. And so that would then be the challenge, of course, if it got into Coos. If we had like a single fine in Coos or Douglas or some county like that, then internationally the whole county would go down versus domestically we might be able to keep it smaller than that.
Please, Representative
Chair Witt, thank you. So does it make a difference if that log is barked, cleaned, and loaded, or if it's chipped first and then shipped? Does it make any difference?
Chair and Representative McCoon, domestically, yes. Internationally, no. If it's international and you're going to one of those seven countries that's listed up there,
nothing,
the requirements that I have listed are okay. What you have to do. Either it's out and out prohibited, and it doesn't matter if it's a boll host like Tan Oak, or it's a non-boll host like Douglas fir, it's just plain prohibited, or it's prohibited unless it's kiln-dried, and from what I understand, kiln-drying a log is not fun. Or it's prohibited unless you have an import permit. And an import permit, that will do is state specifically what you have to do in order to ship that particular product from the quarantine county into that country. And it could be anything from fumigation to, you know, harvesting from a disease-free area to kiln drying to, you know, I mean, they can pretty much write whatever they want to in an import permit.
Okay. Thank you.
So, like I was saying, we did, when we were looking at expanding the quarantine area, we did look at some of the economic impacts of this. Some of the direct costs to timber companies in particular, you have to get rid of that soil and plant debris that's on the logs, so they're going to have to wash them when they're coming out. And this is in particular for Tan Oak and then any Douglas fir from within an infested site. Then, of course, we have the risk of lost markets. I already mentioned there's 52 countries that have quarantines, or that list Phytophthora morum as a quarantine organism. One of the interesting things that I found was in talking to South Coast is that one of the biggest impacts was the fact that they have to leave Tan Oak on the site. And Tan Oak, even though it's a low-value species, it's used mostly for paper pulp chips, it makes it economically feasible to harvest certain sites. Mm-hmm. And so if you have to leave that Tan Oak there, you lose that income. So you're not able to offset the costs of harvesting as easily as you could if you were able to use the Tan Oak. And then, of course, you have to get a certificate for quarantine compliance from us, which means we have to go out and do inspections, and that's a fee-based service. Some of the offsets that we have right now for the timber companies is that we have had consistent support from the U.S. Forest Service. And so ODF has been able to use those funds to provide some of the disease-free surveys. And then, of course, there's also funds available to do treatments, but that are the sites we're able to treat are dwindling in number just because of the funds that are available. In terms of our other products, like the nursery and Christmas tree, you know, we have to be out there monthly. We have to do the annual testing and such. One thing that's different for those industries is that if we do find it in a nursery, the nursery bears the all eradication costs. So not only do they have the lost income, but theoretically they're paying for the destruction of the plant material, the burning and burial, or whatever needs to be done in order to contain it. They of course also deal with lost markets. People that will say we don't want plants from you anymore because we know you've had this problem, and they have to go through the whole certification process to move it. Right now, we also do have federal funds to support it, but I will say that I think it was a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, they slashed that in half. So fortunately, they've also changed the program, so we're better able to handle the nurseries that we have left that are in it, but that was still a little bit of a challenge.
Chair Witt, I want...
Yes.
Thank you. I know a lot of folks who go out, particularly in Curry and southern Coos County, and they're huckleberry picking. Mm-hmm. They're moving huckleberry brush because they want to put them in their yard. And is azalea a host species or just rhododendron, wild rhododendron?
Yes.
Azalea is a rhododendron. Azaleas, so, just
so those beautiful apricot-colored wild azaleas are also a problem, which people have a tendency to want to go out and bring home. So another piece of this education is trying to tell people to leave stuff out where it belongs and not bring it home, because that would be a really easy way to transport this disease too, correct?
Yes.
Okay. If you're out picking huckleberry and you bring huckleberry brush home, is there any danger in transporting it across a county line if you're out doing activities like that?
I would say there's a possibility. The evergreen huckleberry gets the disease. And
you get a few leaves in your huckleberry bucket, and all of a sudden you throw them out in your backyard. And
they'd have to be infected. And if you, well, theoretically, if I'm out collecting huckleberry, I'm going to collect that. Well, I might collect the sick stuff because I'm a plant pathologist, but normal people would collect healthy material.
Yeah.
So the chances in that case would be less, I would think, of picking it up. But there's a possibility that would happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
If the questions are pressing, but I'd like the panel to finish their presentation if we could. And there may be that question that you lose the opportunity, so feel free.
But I'll stop.
If they get through it, and then we'll just open it up for general questions.
All right. So Peter's already alluded to the current situation that's going on in Curry County right now. We have more than 11 new infested sites in 2015. Several are very close to the quarantine boundary. There's one that's actually outside of it. And we know from research that Everett and one of his postdocs, I believe, has done, and I think you're going to talk about it, that Remorum is spreading faster and further than it has in the past. And some of that is due to that intensification of the disease in the generally infested area. Right now, I think that based on comparing the most recent epidemiology data versus the earlier paper that was published, it's the rate of spread has roughly doubled. So all of that has kind of played into how we're approaching the quarantine expansion. So we know we have to expand it. We've got one that's outside of the quarantine boundary. We don't have a choice. We've got to do it. We have had to expand the quarantine area roughly annually since about 2009, so that's been a little bit of a challenge for us, regulatorily speaking, because it's hard to keep up when you've got to make a change every year. So coming into this year, we were really wondering, is this finally the point where we just go whole county and say to heck with it, or do we do one more partial county expansion? So we were weighing a lot of different factors for that. If we do go whole county, the advantage to that is that it would match international boundaries. So in some respects, it would make regulation easier for not only the companies, but for other people, the customers, to understand what's going on. It would roughly match the natural range of tan oak that Peter showed in an earlier slide, because there's a bit of a break between Coos and Curry, so it would kind of match that area. The disadvantage is that you have more landowners that are affected, and there's quite a few small woodlot owners down in Curry County. In terms of the partial expansion, doing that one more time, well, there's the hope that if we do that, maybe we can do one more last-ditch effort and really try to nuke it from orbit and take care of it as much as we can and keep it in Curry as long as we can. You have fewer landowners that are being affected. That's another advantage. The cons, it is going to be more difficult to enforce, especially if you're one of those landowners where maybe that quarantine line bisects your property. So, half your property you've got to worry about and the other half you don't have to worry about. And the partial quarantine is not recognized internationally. It is domestically. So if you're doing domestic shipments, it's easier to do it, to move your material. But internationally, they go by the county boundary. So we did decide that we would probably do one more partial county expansion and give it one last effort to see if we can really kind of keep this thing contained. Right now, the map up there shows the little yellow box. It's a little bit hard to see on the screen. We are going to, after some feedback that we got from Representative Krieger and some others, we are going to change that northern boundary to the Rogue River, just because it's going to be easier for people to understand. And we did check with USDA APHIS to make sure that that was okay with them, because they are very fond of Township Range section and legally defensible boundaries, but they said that it was fine to use the Rogue River instead. The expansion to the east is a little bit less because the Forest Service and BLM have been very good about going in and treating and jumping on things when they find it on their property or near their property. So the expansion in that direction has not been as rapid as it has been to the north. And then we're going to move it down to the state line in the south because of that Windchuck find that, that Peter talked about earlier. So this is actually, let's see, this is actually at public hearing right now down in Gold Beach this morning. So they're getting public input right now from the landowners down there. Even as we speak, that started at 8:30. And if we're accepting written comments on it as well until June 22nd, and any written comments on the proposed expansion can just be sent to the rules coordinator at ODA, and we'll share those with the hearings officer. So that's actually a site that's, I think, that's a homeowner down there, a private landowner, and they had a bunch of dead tan oak. They took it out, and it basically returned to the meadow she remembered from when she was a kid. Okay. And so now it kind of was restored to the habitat it was before the tan oak was allowed to just kind of grow unchecked. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Everett.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Ernie, you said around $5,000 an acre or something like that. Have you run into an incident yet where you have a small farm ranch that has several spots? How are they absorbing the cost of doing that, or do they get assistance, or what's the program?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger. In the quarantine area, we require treatment, but up until now, we have been covering the cost of treatment where it's required. So there's been in-kind contribution. There'd be costs associated if they wanted to reforest. But currently, where we do treatments, we are funding the cost of treatment.
I was just going to say, it would almost be, you could bankrupt a small woodland owner, and you still haven't got the job done. So
yeah,
having proper management after treatment. Now, are you recommending that they convert that back then into multiple species of fir and things of that nature?
Correct. That would be good to not plant tan oak necessarily right back in there. It sprouts, but actually we used to treat the trees with herbicides to prevent sprouting, but it doesn't seem like when they sprout that they're getting reinfected if we've done the treatment effectively.
Thank you. Dr. Hansen.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience. If I were in a classroom, the students would be very restless now and heading for the exit. My job this morning is to try and show you a little bit how this operation actually works on the ground. From day one, we've had a collaboration between the Oregon Department of Forestry, Peter representing, who do the on-the-ground work, Oregon Department of Agriculture, who has the regulatory authority, the USDA Forest Service Forest Health Protection branch represents the federal agencies, and in this case particularly the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, and Oregon State University. And I want to elaborate just a little bit on the role that Oregon State plays in this. We have a number of projects, programs throughout the university and the College of Forestry. There's research on log treatments. I had questions about how do you treat a Douglas fir log, and are there alternatives to kiln drying? And there's research looking for those alternatives. Cost-benefit analysis has been done a couple of times and based out of work in the college. And some particular research with our collaborators in the Forest Service Pacific Northwest Forest Range Experiment Station. In Ag Sciences, where the, my department, Botany and Plant Pathology, is housed. There's quite a considerable program focused on nurseries and sudden oak death and developing best management practices, cooperation with the Oregon Association of Nurseries. And there is also cooperative with the USDA Agricultural Research Service, ARS. Just down the street is where the DNA fingerprinting work is done, which we'll touch on a bit here. My own lab has, in terms of the operational program, we're responsible for the diagnostic end of things on the forest aspects of this disease. Nancy's lab handles the nursery aspects for diagnosis, but anything in the forest comes through my lab. We do the isolation. We do it based on conventional methods and with DNA sequencing. And we've done a lot of work on improving our isolation methods and just the whole methodology and that is put in place in the field to make it a more efficient sampling process. We've done a lot of host range testing, just the two primary hosts that we deal with. Actually, in Oregon, it's exclusively, almost exclusively, tan oak. In California, they worry a lot about the myrtle wood. And economically, it's the Douglas fir. Douglas fir, that's the wilted tip, is as much as you'll ever see on a Douglas fir. It doesn't hardly hurt, touch a Douglas fir tree unless it's growing right underneath an infected tan oak. But in terms of the regulatory apparatus, the international quarantine, it is a host. We've done a lot of work to understand how the disease spreads, and this has been touched on by both Peter and Nancy, the local splash dispersal spread and the longer distance airborne spread, and then our wild card nursery stock spread, and we have to deal with all of these in Oregon as we've learned to understand these pathways. We've very continuously fed that information back into the survey and the reaction, very much a process of adaptive management as we learn as we go along. Almost all of the diseases is the distance from a new find to a previously infected tree. Almost all of it comes very close to the previously infected trees. And our eradication program knocks down that shortest distance. That first bar would be way off scale if it weren't for our eradication. But it's those long-distance dispersal events that we're constantly chasing and force us to do what we can to come up with detection methods that will work before we see dead trees. We monitor streams, we monitor rainfall well beyond the area of quarantine in the attempt to pick up the propagules from the trees before the trees turn color. We've done a lot of work on epidemiology. There was the question about the Rogue River and the threat to the interior counties. This pathogen spreads up the valleys. It's in the streams. The streams carry it out to the ocean. We don't see that it causes new disease from the streams. But the air moves up the valleys in those fogs, and I think the Rogue is a likely pathway should the disease get that far north. And Nancy alluded to the evidence for increasing long-distance spread. As there's more inoculum, our untreated area, we have don't have the money, the wherewithal to treat that core area. This is just pumping out more and more spores, and it increases the probability for longer-distance dispersal. Just a couple of examples of the collaboration of how this team goes together. We'll concentrate on this Pistol River find and the Cape Sebastian find that Peter alluded to. There are those two white circles there to the north of the quarantine area. Well, the Cape Sebastian is just north of that, a red dot. But in any new find is found by first aerial survey from the airplane, followed up with a helicopter to get precise GPS locations. This is done by the Oregon Department of Forestry and the USDA Forest Service, working in the Cooperative Aerial Survey. The samples are then, well, the trees are located from the ground and samples are collected. Those come back to my laboratory where we do the diagnosis. Because of the import of this disease, the quarantine implications, everything is cultured and stored, stockpiled. If it's a positive for Phytophthora removal, the Oregon Department of Forestry, if it's on state or private land, or the Forest Service or BLM, if it's on Forest Service or BLM land, does the actual treatment on the ground using contract crews. The samples also go to that ARS lab for DNA fingerprinting. We're trying to learn more constantly about the pathways of spread within the infested area and the possibilities of introduction from outside. Well, these two specific examples just had a little bit of a wrinkle in the protocol. Cape Sebastian has started with the aerial detection. Samples to OSU were positive, but because at the time this was the furthest north, it was going to trigger a quarantine boundary change, so the samples went to the Oregon Department of Agriculture as well, where they were confirmed and sent back to the federal labs because of the quarantine implications. ODA also then triggered the public hearings for the quarantine expansion. So that's the regulatory aspect of this teamwork. Back the treatment was back ODF working in close cooperation with state parks in that case. This next star south, the Pistol River one, is a sort of a continuing story. I guess it started, there's a small nursery on the Pistol River. There was a small nursery on the Pistol River. And in their normal operations of inspection, nursery inspection that Nancy alluded to, Phytophthora ramorum was found in that nursery. That triggered a local eradication within the nursery. The stock was destroyed. And ultimately the nursery closed. Well, that was the end of it for a couple of years. And then tan oak in the forest was found nearby, about 2 miles away, through the DNA fingerprinting process. We could show that that was very, very likely had its origin in that nursery 2 years previously, illustrating the lag between spread and detection that we struggle with, and also the possibility of this wild card spread. And it's the only time we've had any evidence for that pathway in the Oregon forest. The Cape Sebastian may well have come from a nursery, but it was a California nursery, if that were the case. It was not an Oregon nursery. Well, you might very well ask, why are we doing this? Tan oak, the question came out. No, tan oak's not worth very much. The industry thinks this is a great deal because we pay them to cut down tan oak trees. But the disease is in Curry County, in rural residential areas. It's affecting people. Dead trees are hanging over people's houses, over power lines, over highways. There's fire risk. The industry, the horticultural nursery industry, is a big thing in Oregon. They're impacted through the regulatory quarantine concerns of their customers throughout the country. The timber industry is affected, again, through the quarantine implications and the wild card part of that. There are ecological and cultural issues that get lost because they aren't measured in dollars and cents so readily. But we're losing a native species that plays a very important ecological role in these forests. In California, especially Hoopa, Yurok peoples, it's a very important traditional food source for them as well. And it's a real lots of unknowns in the potential for this disease, demonstrated in England in the last few years, where quite unexpectedly it started killing larch plantations throughout the west coast of the United Kingdom. I suppose we knew that larch was potentially a host, but we had never done anything about it here because our larch grows in the drier east side of the mountains. Well, in England, it's on the wet side of the mountain of their island, and they are losing tens of thousands of hectares of larch plantation to this disease. It's got a huge unknown risk throughout the world. And with
go ahead. And as we close, I'd like to acknowledge the entire Oregon Forest Sudden Oak Death Program team. It's led by the Oregon Department of Forestry as a cooperative effort, as Everett has said, with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon State University, U.S. Forest Service, and Bureau of Land Management. The team has dedicated 14 years of public service responding to sudden oak death. The program has done a remarkable job containing a new, little understood invasive forest pathogen. And actually, the team's efforts are being used as model for future national responses to invasives. The way we approached it, the adaptive management, is being adopted by other states for other diseases. So just wanted to acknowledge that level of service.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Just south of Cape Sebastian, there's quite an area, Alder Creek and down in that is just pretty much all of the standing. They're standing there, but they're standing there dead. The understanding is that no one's going in to take those down within that quarantine area. And I got a call from a constituent that was talking about the fire danger of all that dry material being in there. Some of it's in the second and third year being dead. Can you comment on whether that condition actually exists, where these trees are dying, not coming down in that quarantined area?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, it certainly is occurring in a 58 square mile generally infested area. That's a special part of the quarantine where no treatment is required, and there's not necessarily a source of funding to provide assistance to landowners or property owners for removing those trees. And so there is a risk of increased fire hazard with the standing dead trees, although right now we're in the sort of a conundrum where we can't treat because of the fire restrictions. It's so dry down there.
Please.
Mother Nature's helping you on the other side of the hill with a fire already in the Biscuit Fire. And I've always said if we ever get the Chetco effect, the big westerly winds, it'll burn right to the beach is what's going to happen.
Had the Biscuit gone a couple more days, we wouldn't have sod because the tannock would have all burned up.
Yep. Wow. Vice Chair McLean, followed by Representative Frederick.
I just had two. I was interested in your map that showed the United States, and there was a lot of red down in the south. And so I was wondering if those folks had gotten this disease before we did, if they had some knowledge or some tactics or things like that that were helpful or not because of the difference in our climate area.
Those risk maps are based on comparable climates and potential hosts.
Okay.
So the oaks in particular, particularly evergreen oaks, are susceptible in the lab, and the climate is deemed to be suitable.
Okay.
The disease was first recognized in the San Francisco area in California. In the southeastern United States, it's been in nurseries. We shipped it from the West Coast to their nurseries down there, but it has not been found outside of the nurseries to date.
Okay. That was my second question, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
All right.
And that is, I don't understand what the nursery pathway is, except for destroying their plants. I mean, if they've got it, is there any other kind of treatment or anything else that they can do that they still are not losing their entire income?
Right now, because it's a federally quarantined pathogen, if you find Romorum on a plant in the nursery, the federal regulations require plant destruction.
Of everything.
That's the only treatment option because it's a quarantine status pathogen. Okay. They are exploring, Everett and others at Oregon State University are exploring other options to take care of, like mitigating it in soil if it becomes infested in the soil or something like that. But in terms of having it be in a plant, I mean, they've looked at protectants and those kinds of fungicide treatments, but because of its federal quarantine status, if it's infected, it's a goner.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, first of all, Dr. Hansen, I'm supposed to say hello from my dad, he was giving a discussion, a lecture this week on Sudden Oak, so he wanted to let me know to say hello to you. Secondly, I am curious about a number of things regarding the human-assisted infection.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a few things. So for instance, you mentioned the ornamental collections, and Representative McEwen also mentioned that, you know, lots of people going out and picking up azaleas and whatever in that whole area. But we also have mushrooms that are associated with tan oak, and we have some significant collection of mushrooms. And I am curious about whether that is one of the pathways, because you have folks going out and collecting there, as well as other, you know, hunters and hikers and also some cannabis farmers who have been using that space as well. I just wondered whether there's a way to address those particular pathways for this disease.
We've explored all of those, and they are theoretically possible pathways. I think they're low probability pathways, but given the risks that are involved, even a low probability is perhaps something that you want to try and deal with. The regulatory apparatus that we have is primarily, as mentioned, on the federal lands, and through their permitting process for collection, mushrooms, all the green crops, they do regulate that, and they do have major education programs to those pickers. But that works on the federal lands. There are materials available for state lands and for the private land, but not. We don't have the organized mechanism of reaching.
Well, this is the concern that I have. Follow up, just
please.
This is a concern that I have. It's not so much on the crops or the materials being taken from the area, but on just the cleanliness of coming out, because this can actually be coming out on your shoes.
Sure.
And if you're out there and you come back, you can be tracking it basically into an area. I just, as you look at the maps that you have of the recent infestations, I just wonder, how did it get to that particular spot, and if it was, you know, somebody deciding we have a great place to collect the mushrooms. Is that how that's happening?
Well, it's all possible, and we ask that question constantly. It can be moved in mud on your feet. Nobody has been able to demonstrate that it gets it from the soil back up to start a new disease, and they've tried hard in California. We've tried some in Oregon to demonstrate that. When we look at the pattern of spread statistically, because we map every tree, there is no correlation with roads. We have no evidence that it's being spread along roads, unlike some of our other Phytophthora diseases.
Mm-hmm.
The primary spread in the forest is this airborne spread, hundreds of meters at a jump.
Is there an insect host involved in that?
Not that we've been able to find. We've done a lot of work looking at insects, trapping insects. There are insects certainly involved, and that's part of why how it got its name, sudden oak death. The pathogen kills the tree, but kind of slowly.
but the bark beetles come in and push it over the edge very quickly.
And you know, I don't. My dad's work on Dutch elm disease and the beetles is his
yeah,
baby.
Yeah, we do not seem to have an insect vector for this disease, and we have looked.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative McLean, she's left.
Took off, yeah.
Representative McEwen, did you have a question?
I just have one. Thank you, Chair Witt. Madrone is not a host, is that correct? Because I know there's some issues with... So Madrone is also part of this?
Yes.
Okay.
Wow.
That's
yes.
Bad news.
Yeah. And yes, it is, and it's bad news in several ways. In California, Madrone is damaged and I think in some cases killed by this pathogen. In Oregon, there's not so much Madrone in the actual area where the disease is active. So we've not seen disease on Madrone in Oregon at all, I don't think. But Madrone has so many other problems right now that it's all very confusing, and it makes it a hard problem, that just the diagnosis to sort out what's going on.
Yes. I have Vice Chair Krieger, followed by Representative Esquivel.
We couldn't be so fortunate that possibly it could affect marijuana, could we? Have you tested that?
I have not. But I'm not at all sure about what people in California have, and I can't remember what those results would have been, and they may not have been publicly disclosed. I'm sorry. Not a very satisfactory answer.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had this presentation maybe 8 years ago, something like that. I've noticed the maps change substantially. How much is this disease spreading per year? Because if my memory serves me correct, it wasn't up to Pistol River last time.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, you're correct. The last time we presented it was in 2012, so a little over 2 years ago. We wasn't up at the Pistol River. We had had the Cape Sebastian site, but we had locally eradicated it there. So we overall, I think our rate of spread has been 1.5 to 2 miles over the length of the program. But more recently, over the past 3 years, we're thinking it's approaching three to four miles per year on average. And again, that's on average. We can see these longer jumps. Often, though, the longer jumps, we'll find a site that we didn't see in that year intermediate between the jumps. So, yes, the rate of spread has increased over the past few years.
Please.
Now, I'm sorry, I missed the first part of this. I had other things I was attending to, but the first part of your presentation. What about white oak? A little scrub oak. Is it susceptible to this disease as well?
In artificial inoculation, it is susceptible, although not dramatically so. We have not found any infected white oak in the forest, although, again, white oak, for the most part, doesn't grow in the area where the disease is present. There is some overlap now. And I believe it's true. We've still not found any infected white oak.
Okay, but does definitely Madrone. So my concern is in Southern Oregon, we have a lot of scrub oak.
Yeah.
We have a lot of Madrone.
Yeah. Our concern has been exactly. What is the future of this disease? Well, if we do nothing, it's going to move up the coast and through the range of tan oak, and it'll take out the tan oak. But rhododendron, huckleberry, madrone, other susceptible plants, their range goes well right up to British Columbia. Does this disease have the potential to continue moving north? We don't have an answer for that. I'm increasingly thinking not. We see very little spread in the understory, in the shrub, in the rhododendron, huckleberry, those plants are infected when they're beneath a tan oak, but it doesn't seem to carry in those. But with this larch story in Britain, it would be foolish to guess what the future might hold for this thing.
Representative McEwen.
Chair Witt, thank you. I want to thank you for coming today, that the work that you're doing to try and get the word out about this. I see this as a significant threat to our the economy of the South Coast in the long run if we don't do something to try and contain it. And I'm interested in having a conversation at some point in this body about the investment or the lack of investment that we're making in trying to slow down the movement of this very, very significant disease. And, you know, you've brought this to us. I think it needs to have an exclamation point on it. I know the word is beginning to get out that this is something that we all need to be paying attention to. I'm not sure we're paying attention to it at the level that we should. So I'm very grateful for your time today and the expertise that you bring to us. And I'm very interested in continuing this conversation, Chair Witt, at a budgetary level and making sure that we're making the investment in this that we need to make to do everything we can to slow the progression down.
Thank you very much. That's probably a good segue into one of the questions that I wanted to ask. First off, are other states that are experiencing these infections, are they doing their part to try and arrest the spread of the disease? I've heard repeatedly today, you know, that money is always a factor, and I clearly understand that. Are other states also challenged in being able to arrest the spread? Where are we at?
Chair, in terms of where it is in the natural environment, California is really the only other state that is dealing with it in the natural environment right now. And California, quite frankly, is big enough and has a large enough internal market that it's not as of concern to them as it is to us. We are primarily an exporting state in terms of moving plant products around. So for them, you know, I actually called them because we were worried about, you know, what happens if it gets up into Coos Bay and how do we handle timber exports and how do we, you know, do the certificates and stuff. And they said, well, we just don't export our timber because we've got enough market here. So we just don't, that way we don't have to worry about doing all that stuff. And we just, you know, debark them and we can do it all right here in California. So it's a very different climate down there in terms of some of the issues that they're dealing with and that their constituents are dealing with. In terms of what's happening in nurseries, that's a little bit different because they do a lot more interstate shipments of nursery stock. So there, they are more invested in what's going on, and they get a significant amount of money from USDA APHIS, and then it goes to their, to my, to our agency's equivalent, and then trickles down to the counties to help with interstate movement of nursery stock. But in terms of timber, it's not something they really deal with. Washington also has to deal with it in nurseries, and they do it also using federal funds. So there's not that, it's not the same kind of impact. So what we're really the only state that's made a concerted effort to try to stop this thing in the forest and keep it contained. So we're kind of our own best measure for how much it costs to do this and the financial impact it's had.
I'm concerned that try as we might, because of the need for additional resources to be able to efficaciously attack this problem, that we are in essence a bad neighbor. And if it's true that possibly the disease started or spread to Oregon from California, I'm really concerned that, you know, for the lack and want of resources, we may be threatening the rest of the West Coast as well. And I think this underscores Representative McEwen's concerns that we need to attack this. We need to attack it head on, and we need to be allocating additional resources. Where are we in terms of good neighbor, bad neighbor?
Maybe I've got a little more freedom to speak to this one than my agency colleagues here. The DNA fingerprinting evidence suggests that the Oregon nursery infestations came from Canada and Washington into Oregon in the nurseries.
Okay.
They're the bad neighbors.
Okay.
The California forest situation was larger than anything we have in Oregon now, mm-hmm. when it was first defined. They had no opportunity to give them not credit, but to understand their, they really had no opportunity to even try for an eradication. But they didn't even try, and they haven't. And now they find that their last county standing on the coast, Del Norte County, is imminently threatened. Mm-hmm. And now they're worrying about maybe they should try and do something to protect Del Norte County.
Yes.
Well, at this point in time, the Del Norte is threatened as much from our Windchuck infestation as it is from their Humboldt infestation.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we don't have money to do anything with the Windchuck, and they don't have an organization to do anything with, although they're trying with the southern thing. I wouldn't want to be in Del Norte County right now if you were worried about sudden oak death.
I see. Having seen what happened as a result of the chestnut blight and the loss of just a absolutely glorious tree, I wanted to follow up on Representative Esquivel's earlier question. Are there other oak species, maybe red oak, black oak, poison oak, I don't know, that would be that wouldn't be all
go
bad,
for it,
by
yeah.
the way. But are there other species that are potentially threatened at this point?
The oaks, broadly, we could divide them in two groups: the white oaks and the black oaks. Many species in each group. The black oaks are much more susceptible. And in California, Quercus calagii, the California black oak, where it occurs in the diseased areas, is being killed. And then sometimes it'd be a third group of oaks, the white oaks, the live oaks, the evergreen oaks,
okay.
and they are largely susceptible as well. Poison oak is quite another critter.
Yes.
But it is susceptible, and it is killed if it's trying to climb up a diseased tan oak tree.
Uh-huh.
My lab demonstrated that, and I almost lost a technician over it. She thought that was probably above and beyond the things I rightly should ask her to do.
Well, given the state of affairs, what would your recommendations be in order to be able to effectively check the spread of this disease? And I recognize that there may be a hierarchy of orders of what we would be able to achieve, but in terms of trying to triage the situation, which at least to me has the appearance that this thing could blow up quite seriously here, and perhaps already has if the spread is now doubled. What would your recommendations be to a committee such as this one for our consideration?
Chair Witt and members of the committee, at this point we're doing the analysis. The SOD technical team, I briefly mentioned the four alternatives. Those are in development. We have not really been able yet to put a price tag on what that would take. If you remember the invasion curve in Curry County, we're at the high end of costs now for containment, and it's likely that eradication in Curry is not possible any longer. So we are developing alternatives. We would like to continue the analysis on that, get some costs, think about the program structures it would take, because as the disease has expanded, the amount of treatment that's occurring, the amount of early detection and survey, those costs are going up. So we'd like to be able to develop good estimates of cost and some expectation of level of success. And so the alternatives range from continuing kind of what we're doing to thinking more proactively about how do we respond, you know, keeping it contained within Curry, but also developing the program that could respond when we get that unexpected infestation either out of Curry and a different county or way far away or in that action zone. So at this point, you know, we are on schedule to flesh out those alternatives, and we could bring them back to this committee in the interim session or during one of your interim sessions and provide you more detail at that time.
Well, and
Chair,
could I add one thing
to what he said? Something that's important to remember from the regulatory standpoint is that the only reason we're able to do partial county quarantines is because we're doing something. If we did as California was doing, they had a fine in Trinity County. It was right on the border. They chose not to do anything. So that left the federal government with no choice but to quarantine the entire county for domestic shipments as well. So if something like that happens and we have a jump to Coos or a jump to Douglas and we choose not to do anything, then the federal government will quarantine the entire county. So domestic shipments for the entire county will be affected, instead of just maybe one little corner where we go in and do something. So that's, I just wanted to add that bit as well.
I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I think Representative McEwen was suggesting that a call to action is needed. And if she didn't, I am. And I want to ask you a time frame when you think that you've had adequate time to do your studies and put everything together. When would be a logical time for us to be considering inviting you back? And if it's a matter of that's something that you need to think on and get back to us, that's a...
Chair Witt and members of the committee, yes, I'd like to pull together the SOD technical team that would be responsible for doing this work and work with their managers both within my department and let Oregon Department of Agriculture come up with an estimate of time rather than me putting them under an unreasonable estimate.
Quite reasonable. And... should we ever be fortunate enough, maybe the possibility exists. I do not know, but maybe Dr. Frederick could
if I could get him out here, he'd love it.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I have Representative McEwen followed by Vice Chair Krieger.
Very quickly, sir, I appreciate your willingness to draw attention to a call to action. I'm sure Representative Krieger would be happy to join us in that. And I just wanted to ask Representative Krieger if when he gets in his truck to drive up here on Sunday that he's sterilizing his shoes before he gets in his vehicle.
Good idea.
That's going to be the type of problem I would suggest.
I think we should spray.
If you find a tree in both Buckley and Devlin's backyard, we've got it made.
Thank you, Chair Witt.
If we could find a way to infect some of Representative Esquivel's poison oak, that wouldn't all be
bad.
That
would be great, wouldn't it? We have a bumper crop of poison oak in Southern Oregon. It's over your head.
Yeah. Good year for the poison oak.
Anything further, committee members? Panel members, I want to thank you very, very much. And I think you can, the general level of concern is palpable. And when it's appropriate, if you would please let us know, we want to have you back, and we want to address with the certainty the importance of this disease and our. Trying to check its expansion. And with that, again, thank you so very, very much for your testimonies and your appearance. Greatly appreciated.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Committee members, and I'm going to close the informational session. Committee members, we had discussed, and Chuck's been working very hard here over the past couple of weeks, trying to put everything together for a possible fermentation field trip on Thursday. Plot thickens in that we simply do not know whether or not we are going to be having an afternoon session that day. Some of us may also have other committees that are going on for which we could potentially get those members excused, but if we don't have floor session and we can get you excused, are there how many might be interested in attending?
I'm two. If it
two.
Works.
I'm three.
I think I have something Thursday afternoon.
I do in the afternoon.
Okay. Representative Frederick, would that be something?
That would be fine.
Okay, so that would be a four. The question has also come up whether staff would be able to join us, and I see no reason why we would exclude them. They work very hard for all of us and might want to also make sure that the quality of our fermentation products are up to snuff. So, with that, yes, please.
I am going to go to Ferris Lumber tomorrow and watch the ways that they've technologically advanced the wood product industry in making of veneer and of boards, of doing sawmills. So, if someone would like to go, let us know, and we'll see if that makes acceptable.
Perfect. I need to talk to you about that then. All right.
Have a rotary clipper on.
With that, we are adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.